This is Phil Farron, and I am driving home. It's Thursday today. It's actually a little early because I'm going home, and my wife and I are going to spend a little time together for our wedding anniversary, so that's cool. 25 years we've been married. Doesn't hardly seem possible. 25 years. Anyways, so I'm not coming back in tomorrow. And it's been a good week. We've gotten a lot of things done. I was rushing to get things done since I was going to leave work a little early today. And I pretty much got all the things done I wanted to get done today. There were a few interruptions and wasn't sure we were going to make it there for a while, but you know what? I think we got enough of it done that it's okay. So it's going to be great. On the writing front, I've just been making corrections to Amanda and the Hare-Footed Flame. I don't know if I mentioned last week. No, I don't think I would have mentioned last week. I sent out all the books on... Wait, I don't know. I put them in the mail on Thursday morning. Friday morning. Maybe Friday morning I put them in the mail. Got everything all packaged up. And some of them, obviously, were delivered to Springfield. One of my co-workers there wanted to be a beta reader, and so I shipped one off to him. And so he would have gotten it probably Saturday. And the book is 300 pages. He came in on Monday, said, "I read your book." He said, "Really? Really?" He said, "Yeah, done." I said, "Well, what'd you think?" He said, "I liked it." "Well, good. Thank you. I'm glad you liked it." So then he had actually read the first Amanda book, and this was the third one. He said, "I think I missed one somewhere." And I said, "Yeah, there's one in the middle called Amanda and the Hare-Footed Flame." And so I sent him a PDF of that one so he could get caught up. And just as I was leaving today, he said, "I'm on chapter 17 of Amanda and the Hare-Footed Flame." I said, "Okay." So, you know, that's nice. That's always nice as an author when people seem to be enjoying your work, and he seemed to be enjoying it. So, hey, yay for that. Been doing a lot more thinking, a lot more chatting with friends about the whole Windfall idea and the whole series. And, you know, I've mentioned that I was probably going to get Poser, and I was going to try to do the, you know, fantasy covers, you know, with the posing buxom and muscly men and stuff. And the more I think about that, I don't know about doing that. But now, of course, I'm trying to figure out, okay, what else will I do with the covers? And I was thinking, the latest idea that I had, but I was thinking that maybe what I should do, since each of the books is not only going to be based on a phrase from Yeats's Second Coming, but each of the books is also going to be based on some fragment. I'm going to turn on the air to blow a little bit. It's actually a little warm. But they say out in Washington, D.C. that it's going to be in the 70s. And I wasn't supposed to say that. So never mind. So not only is each book based on a phrase out of that poem, each book is also based on some phrase or some parable that contains the words, "the kingdom of heaven." And so I'm going to kind of use this to take the parables and try to look at them in a different light, since the great thing about parables is they were designed to be confusing, and so I think some of our standard interpretations of them might not quite be what Jesus had in mind, and so that's going to give me some license to explore different aspects of those parables. My son-in-law wasn't really that thrilled with that explanation. But that's okay. You know, he's an ordained minister. So I'm wondering now if maybe I could use an image from each of the parables on the cover. The problem is finding, it's absolutely impossible to find that many images, 24 in a row on something like iStock Photo, that all match or that would all be in a style that I would want to put on the covers of my books. I have found some, but they're all kind of children's book illustrations, and this is definitely not going to be a children's series. So that's not going to work. So then my fallback position, whenever I can't find something as far as a picture goes, my fallback position is always and has always been iconography. Can I create some kind of iconography that will allow me to illustrate a front cover that, you know, I kind of like, and yet without requiring a lot of artistic skill? It's one of those things in my life I just really wish I had spent more time practicing to become a better drawer, but I haven't. So you just have to improvise. So anyways, but that's all coming along. That's all fine. This week, I watched a really interesting TED Talk. I had heard a lot of these pieces, but I thought there was some interesting stuff in the TED Talk. The TED Talk was by Elizabeth Loftus, I think her name is pronounced. And the name of her talk was The Fiction of Memory. It's pretty interesting. What she studies is not why we forget things or how we forget things, but she studies how we remember them. And she specifically studies the malleability of memory. How that our memories are really not like computer memory or like computer hard drives, where you write data and that data is fixed and impermeable. But in fact, it mutates and you can force it to mutate. She said in her talk, her illustration was that memory is more like a Wikipedia entry, because not only can you rewrite it, others around you can rewrite it, which that's a pretty interesting idea. So she started off her talk with a discussion of a case that she had been involved in. There was a man named Steve Titus. This is a sad story. Wow, this kind of story sends chills up your spine. So Steve Titus is a restaurant manager. He's 31 years old. He lives in Seattle, Washington. He's engaged to Gretchen, the love of his life. His life is going swimmingly. So they're out one night as a couple. They have a nice romantic meal at a dinner restaurant. And on the way home, he's pulled over by a police officer. The difficulty is that there has been a female hitchhiker who has said and has been raped. Not going to cast any aspersions on the female hitchhiker, but she's been raped. And Steve, unfortunately, looks a bit like, resembles this hitchhiker a little bit, and he's driving a car that resembles the car that he looks like the rapist, and he's driving a car that looks like the car that the rapist was driving. So the police, you know, take him in for questioning. They take a picture of him. They take a bunch of different pictures. They show it to the female hitchhiker. She looks through all of them. She points to Steve Titus's photo, and she says, quote, "That's the one that's closest." So the police go, okay, great. And so they arrest him. Prosecution goes forward. They have a trial. Put on trial for rape. The rape victim gets on the stand and then says, "I am absolutely positive that that's the man." So her memory goes from "that's the one that's closest" to "I'm absolutely positive that's the man." And he was convicted. All through this, he's proclaiming his innocence. You know, his family is screaming at the jury. His fiance collapses on the floor sobbing. Steve Titus is taken away to jail. He completely loses faith in the legal system at this point. And so he finally gets the interest of an investigative journalist. And the journalist goes out and actually finds the real rapist. And the man that they find ultimately confesses to like 50 different rapes in the area. So all the information goes back before the judge. The judge looks it all over. He says, he just overturns the conviction. He sets Steve Titus free. And the speaker said, you know, you would think that that would be the end of it. That at the end of this horrible year, it was over and he could get on with his life. Unfortunately, she started off by saying, Steve Titus was so bitter. He'd lost his job, he couldn't get it back, he lost his fiance, she couldn't put up with his persistent anger. He had lost his entire savings. So he decided to file a lawsuit against the police and others whom he felt were responsible. And she said, and that's when I started working on the case. Trying to figure out how this victim went from, that's the one that's closest, to I'm absolutely positive that's the guy. She said Steve Titus was consumed with this civil case. Spent every waking moment thinking about it. And just days before he was to have his day in court, he woke up in the morning, doubled over in pain, and died of a stress-related heart attack at 35 years old. And when I was listening to this, I just thought, wow, this is such a sad story. I mean, beyond all the stuff that she talked about with memory, this struck me as such a sad story. Because this man's flesh agreed what happened to him was horrible. But this man's flesh had so consumed him, had so gotten him to focus on how he had been wronged, that bitterness ate him up and killed him. And I think the lesson just from this first part is really simple to see. There's going to be mistakes in life. There's going to be people who wrong you, whether rightly or wrongly or consciously or unconsciously or intentionally or unintentionally. There are going to be people who harm you. And what you do with that harm will then determine the course and the attitude and the atmosphere of your life. Anyway, so she started there, and then she started talking about the experiments that they're doing. And frankly, the experiments they're doing, they're a little unnerving. She said there's some very simple tweaking techniques that you can do to memory. She said, we showed people a car accident. You know, front of the car tipped on its side, front end, kind of smashed in a little bit. she asked them, first question they asked some of the people was how fast were the cars going when they hit each other? So people answer that question. Then they had another group of people, they asked, how fast were the cars going when they smashed into each other? Okay, well, the people who heard the question smashed in, of course, rated it higher. Oh yeah, it's higher. And not only did they rate it higher, they were sure when asked that there was glass scattered around on the ground at the accident when in fact there was none. So they remembered something that wasn't there simply because of how a question was phrased. She said, in another study, we showed a simulated accident where a car went through an intersection with a stop sign. And she said, we asked a question that insinuated that it was a yield sign. And many witnesses later reported seeing a yield sign at an intersection, not the stop sign. So she goes on to say that not only can you do that, they have done studies where they have actually implanted memories simply through techniques like this, implanted memories in people of being lost when they were a kid, of drowning, you know, having a drowning accident and almost dying when they were a kid. And she said a third to a quarter to a third, sometimes a half the people, they could actually get them to be absolutely certain that that happened to them as a child, which is a little spooky. And she said there came a point in the 1990s when she said we began to see some extreme memories coming out of people with this whole repressed memory dredging that happens sometimes. And she said of these horrific brutalizations, sometimes in satanic rituals, sometimes bizarre, with bizarre and unusual elements. She said there was one patient that clearly recalled that she was forced by this satanic group to be pregnant over and over, and then they cut the babies out of her and all this. And there was no physical evidence that this had ever happened, but she was absolutely convinced. And she said she began to wonder if some of the things in psychotherapy, like imagination exercises or dream therapy, or in some cases hypnosis, or in some cases exposure to false information, were leading these patients to develop these bizarre and unlikely memories. And of course, she said, once I posed that question to the general public, there was this huge backlash. And she actually got involved with another case where there was a woman who accused her mother of sexual abuse. And she said, I got involved with this case and investigated it, and I became convinced that, in fact, that hadn't happened. She said, I ended up writing an article on it. She said, I hid all the names, but she explained the process by which it could occur. And she ended up getting sued by the daughter who was claiming the sexual abuse. And she said, it was 5 years I was fighting against this lawsuit and finally got clear of it. One of the things that made me smile, she said, now I do want to add that it might seem like we are traumatizing these experimental subjects in the name of science, the ones they've implanted memories in, but our studies have gone through evaluation by research ethics boards and that have made the decision that the temporary discomfort that some of these subjects might experience in these studies is outweighed by the importance of this problem for understanding memory processes and the abuse of memory that is going on in some places of the world. I just went, okay, so we'll just justify away some of this stuff. Anyways, what was interesting is she said these false memories that we plant, they can also have repercussions. You can change behavior. So if we implant a false memory of someone getting sick, eating a certain type of food, they will be less likely to eat that type of food. And she even went so far as to say that she thought it was a good idea to implant false memories in our kids about the types of foods they like. Wait a minute. But she said, because, you know, when you, where is that case? Therapists can't ethically plant false memories in the minds of their patients, even if it would help their patient. But there's nothing to stop a parent from trying this out on their overweight or obese teenager. And I suggested publicly When I suggested this publicly, it created an outcry. There she goes again. She's advocating that parents lie to their children. And then she put, you know, a picture of Santa Claus up on the screen. That was cute. She says, hello, Santa Claus. Of course, everybody laughs. But her response to that was, another way to think about this, which would you rather have, a kid with obesity, diabetes, shortened lifespan, and all the things that go with it, or a kid with one little bit of extra false memory? I know what I would do, what I would choose for a kid of mine. Okay. He. I don't know what to do with that. But anyways, she says, and I've actually believed this from some time. She said, you know, we really can't reliably distinguish between false memories and true ones. And she said, because of that, she said, it really doesn't matter how passionate someone is about it or how much they say they believe something. She said, you really need independent corroboration, which was kind of interesting with some of the stories that I relate. Because, like, I have one story that I relate about my mom telling me about something I did as a kid when I try to illustrate how over and over my mom would say, have you asked Jesus? And I don't actually remember it. I just heard my mom saying that for years and years. So, but I think I know my mom well enough to know she wouldn't tell me that she wouldn't intentionally tell me that when it didn't happen just to get me thinking that Jesus would always help me. Anyways, but really interesting talk. Obviously, it's a fascinating, dangerous, intriguing error. And, there's more to come with it. For now, though, this is Phil Ferrand, and I have made it home.